Mr. Turner, please be seated. I understand we're starting with State versus Corbett this morning. Second case on the calendar. And I take it the parties are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mary Swift here on behalf of Mr. Corbett. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
4 minutes? Okay.
Your Honors, I'd like to focus on two issues raised in the briefing. The first is the need for a domestic violence expert when the 404B evidence is admitted regarding past domestic violence between the two, between the defendant and the victim, and also the articulation requirement in WPIC 4.01. First, the current state of the law is that the counterintuitive dynamics of a domestic violence relationship are not within the understanding of an ordinary layperson. And when I say that, I'm relying on State versus Siski and State versus Allery. And those cases have not been overruled or abrogated in any way. Of course, there's been cases since then, Majors and Gunderson, in which the court has admitted 404B evidence, but never directly addressed the issue of whether an expert is needed in this context.
But doesn't the exception that the Supreme Court carved out in Gunderson fit this case? I mean, where there's some kind of inconsistency or recantation?
It does, yes. The factual scenario fits in terms of, and I'm not challenging the admissibility of the evidence. I agree that there's the recantation situation that Gunderson and Majors acknowledged were make the evidence relevant. But basically, you need an expert to testify about these counterintuitive dynamics of a domestic violence relationship. And that's because the average juror might say, well, why wouldn't this person just leave her partner?
Do you think that's still the case with all we know about domestic violence now?
I think that there has been increasing knowledge and awareness of domestic violence, but I would still say that, you know, just looking at the court's opinions in these cases, the courts are still looking at experts and scholarly work on this issue. You know, the dissent in Majors is from 2008, and in that case, Justice Johnson said, we need an expert on this.
But it's still a dissent.
Correct. It's a dissent to the extent that he dissented and said this evidence shouldn't be admissible. What the majority did was too broad. The majority didn't address whether an expert was needed, though, and that wasn't at issue before the court. And so to the extent that an expert is needed or not, Majors is not controlling because that was not presented to the court. And so we have basically Siski and Allery and agreed that there has been increased awareness of domestic violence relationships, but without that expert, we basically have, look, this has happened before between Mr. Corbett and Mrs. Harris. The jury taking a look at that evidence of prior assaults and saying, well, he must have done it again here, too. He's done it before. He's done it here. And that's propensity evidence, and that is not allowed under 404B. As I've acknowledged, Gunderson, Majors controls the admissibility of the evidence in terms of whether it's relevant, but an expert is needed to establish the probative value of that.
Wasn't one of the objections in Siski and other cases was that, indeed, the expert was in itself propensity evidence, and how would that be different in this context?
I get Siski and Allery mixed up specifically, but I believe in one of those cases, they limited the expert testimony. The expert was not allowed to testify as to the ultimate conclusion of whether the crime at issue occurred, but just whether there was, in fact, a domestic violence relationship between the defendant and the victim. And that's basically what defense counsel was asking for here. And that's necessary to establish even whether there is a domestic violence relationship. And that's what the dissent in Majors explains. And then whether that is what's happening here and whether the inconsistencies of the victim's testimony can be attributed to a domestic violence relationship. And that doesn't go to the ultimate issue of whether Mr. Corbett has committed first degree burglary, just whether that type of relationship is present here. In terms of WPIC 4.01, I know this court has been saying that Bennett controls this issue. similar to the DV expert issue, Bennett doesn't control. Bennett was addressing the Castle instruction.
Why not? Why are we not bound by Kalebaugh?
Kalebaugh actually supports the argument that I'm making. Kalebaugh says the law does not require a reason to be given for a juror's doubt, and said, if the jury is instructed, a doubt for which a reason can be given, that's error. And said, okay, a doubt for which a reason exists is fine, but proceeded on the assumption that that has been unchallenged. Now, in the reply briefing, I've talked about how, okay, Kalebaugh is proceeding on that presumption that WPIC 4.01 is correct. But we take a look at the history of these cases. Thompson, I believe, is the only one where this instruction has actually been challenged. Thompson relied on this case, State versus Harris. Harris was addressing the instruction, a doubt for which a good reason exists, and cited this note in a Mississippi case, which I've distributed to the panel. And in that case, the Mississippi court said, a doubt for which a reason exists and a doubt for which a reason can be given are the same thing, and they're fine. And so Kalebaugh is resting on the assumption that there's a difference between these two. But if we trace the history back, there's actually no difference between the two. I'll use just a little bit of a rebuttal time. There's actually no difference between these two. And if we just look at the plain language of the instructions, they clearly require an articulation requirement. And of course, I've also discussed in the reply brief some of these fill-in-the-blank cases. The prosecutors didn't create the fill-in-the-blank arguments out of thin air. They come from WPIC 4.01, and in fact, I believe it was Anderson and Johnson, which are both cited in the briefing. The prosecutor specifically talks about WPIC 4.01 immediately before asking the jury to fill in the blank. And so if legal professionals are interpreting WPIC 4.01 that way, how can we expect jurors not to be? I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, you have 2 minutes to rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Seaver. I'm here on behalf of the state of Washington. Actually, I was hoping to address the first issue raised in the appellant's brief concerning the claim that dismissal was required because the investigating detective appears to have offered a witness to replace a witness's knife block that had been taken into evidence. I can address the 404B question and the reasonable doubt instruction if the court has questions, but I'd like to begin by discussing that just because it was something that I found was a little bit more fleshed out in Ms. Swift's reply brief as opposed to the opening brief. In her reply brief, she contended that the detective's offer here amounted to a deprivation of the defendant's right to due process, justifying or necessitating dismissal. And I just wanted to make clear that, you know, what the detective said to this witness was pretty dumb and a little bit inexplicable. But dismissal due to police misconduct on the basis of a due process violation is warranted in only really the most glaring circumstances, when police do something that's so shocking that it, quote unquote, violates notions of fundamental fairness. That's from State versus Lively, the Supreme Court case that Ms. Swift cited in her reply brief. And I'd recommend that case to this court as well, because that case involves some really unseemly acts by a state agent. The court may recall that in Lively, an informant would troll Narcotics Anonymous meetings and try to form relationships with recovering addicts. In Lively's case, he formed a romantic relationship with Ms. Lively and then tried to persuade her to abandon her recovery and buy drugs from him for him. He'd sabotage these people's recovery efforts, get them to commit crimes at his request, and then report them to the police. And even in a situation that bad, and I don't mean to make light of it, it was a 5-4 decision by the state Supreme Court to dismiss the case due to police misconduct. Four justices still didn't think that warranted dismissal. The five who did, however, looked at whether the police instigated a crime, whether they whether the agent overcame the defendant's reluctance to commit a crime by playing on her sympathies or her emotions, whether the police were in control of the crime, what the state agent's motive was, whether the police engaged in conduct that itself was either criminal or was, like, odious and repugnant. And none of that actually happened here, which is probably why I suspect the defendant's trial counsel didn't even attempt to move for dismissal under Criminal Rule 8.3. And because of that, we obviously don't have as much of a factual record as was present in Lively, on which we can make any general conclusions. But it seems that really all the detective did here was try to encourage a potentially reluctant witness to honor a subpoena and appear and testify in a DV case, and somehow got it into his head that it was a good idea to try to offer to replace an item that the defendant had used as a weapon and had been seized as evidence. But I think more importantly, there's no evidence here that the detective was actually trying to bribe a witness. Bribing a witness under the RCW requires conferring or offering to confer a benefit that will, in order to influence or color a witness's testimony, not simply to get them to appear in court. And also, the jury heard everything about this and could assess the detective's and the witness's credibility. The witness said this had no influence on his decision. It's really nothing like Lively. Really, what happened here is probably less, less potentially concerning or uncomfortable than your average case where the police use a paid informant. As to the 404B issue, just very briefly, Judge Cox, as you noted, the cases relied on by the defense here are pretty old. They're 30, 40 years old. And I think the court recognizes that, you know, the understanding of the average layperson is a little bit different now than it was back then. In fact, in Siskey, they talk about how the need for an expert was to discuss battered woman syndrome was in the context of a cultural change from the idea that any victim of abuse would immediately report to the police. That was the previous understanding, and that's no longer kind of the common understanding. With regard to the reasonable doubt instruction, this court held last month in Lizarraga that Bennett and Pirtle really control here, and I think this court's hands are somewhat tied on that subject. That's something that the Supreme Court may want to reconsider, but it hasn't. With that, if the court has no further questions, I'll just yield the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Just to respond briefly on the misconduct issue, the state has perfectly lawful ways to get a witness to appear through a subpoena or material witness warrant. That's not what happened here. They offered the witness new knives and a knife set at a point in time when he was, claiming he was unable to identify Mr. Corbett and did not want to participate in the proceeding. So the logical implication of that is that the police officer was offering him that monetary benefit in order to influence his testimony and identify Mr. Corbett. If the court has no further questions for me, we'll ask this court to reverse.
Thank you, counsel. Are the parties